So we have the Noahic covenant, and then what happens between the Noahic covenant? What happens next?
Abraham.
Tower of Babel.
Come on, Abe.
Come on, Abe. There's more to that, but there's a lot of kingdom stuff there too. It's man kind of trying to do their own thing and be their own ruler. Look what we can do. God comes down and confuses them because they're on the verge of, again, trying to build man's kingdom and not paying attention to God's kingdom. So then God is now initiating with man more specifically. I love the story of Abraham because we have Abraham who was worshiping the moon god, basically, in what would have been Babylon area, and God comes to him and makes this covenant that we're going to look at. And the story of Abraham is him getting to know God. He's learning who God is. And so it's a really cool faith story because we start with him having no idea really who Yahweh is. He's a polytheist. He would have believed in the reality that he may have even sacrificed to Molech is a potential reality. I mean, we don't really know. But just in the culture that he grew up in. And God takes him from that, and he learns who Yahweh is, and then we kind of see the end of his story, not the very end of his story, but kind of the pinnacle of his faith is his son Isaac, and I have theories on that that maybe we'll talk about in a little bit. But, so he comes to Abraham, verse 1 in chapter 12. He says, "Now the Lord said to Abraham..." So just real quick, there's the genealogies that go from the Tower of Babel that brings Adam to Abraham. So again, a lot of the genealogies are reminding us the flow of Scripture. We're going from moving from Adam, now we're Abraham. So then the Lord said to Abram, "Go from your country and your kindred and your father's house to the land I will show you, and I will make you And I will make of you a great nation, and I will bless you and make your name great so that you will be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you, and him who dishonors you I will curse, and in you all the families of the earth shall be blessed." So this is kind of a quick, we're gonna expound on this a little bit, but in chapter 15. Abrahamic covenant. Okay, so we have, who's the covenant between?
God and Abraham.
God and Abraham.
Abraham's offspring.
Yes, and I'm going to put offspring.
Offspring.
Okay, so what is promised? So there's three, so this is a good way to remember this. There's three quick things that we think Abrahamic covenant.
Land,
seed, and blessing. So land, seed, blessing. So land, seed, and blessing. Okay, let's go to chapter 15. Skip over there, and we're going to get some more specific details. So this is kind of a ratification and expansion of the first three verses that we just read. I'm going to see how much I'm going to read of this. We'll just start in verse 1. So after these things, the word of the Lord came to Abram in a vision. "Fear not, Abraham, I am your shield. Your reward shall be very great." But Abram said, "O Lord God, what will you give me, for I continue childless? And the heir of my house is Eliezer of Damascus." And Abram said, Behold, you have given me no offspring, and a member of my household will be my heir. And behold, the word of the Lord came to him, "This man shall not be your heir. Your very own son shall be your heir." And he brought him outside and said, "Look towards the heaven, the number of the stars, if you are able to number them." Then he said to him, "So shall your offspring be." And he believed the Lord, and it counted to him as righteousness. So this is a big verse just in the understanding of salvation in the Old Testament. So some people will try to say, well, dispensationalism believes in two different salvations. Wrong. Old Testament, New Testament are saved in the same way, faith. Saved by faith through grace in what the Lord has revealed. Okay, so remember progressive revelation. So Abraham has had faith in everything that God has revealed to him. And that faith is counted to him as righteousness. Okay, make sense?
It's big stuff.
Yeah, we'll keep reading. So then he said to him, I am the Lord who brought you out of the Ur of the Chaldeans to give you this land to possess. So again, you've already heard the seed. It's going to be as many as the stars if you can count them. That's how many it's going to be. Then you see here, we're just talking about the land. But he says, O Lord God, how am I to know what I shall... man, I can't read. O Lord, how am I to know that I shall possess it? And he said to him, bring me a heifer. Okay, so now we have this scenario. I'm going to read it real quick and we'll kind of walk through it. Bring me a heifer 3 years old, a female goat 3 years old, a ram 3 years old, a turtle dove, and a young pigeon. Did you bring your goats?
You should have let me know.
It'd have been messy. And he brought him all these, cut them in half, and laid each half over against the other, and he did not cut the bird in half. And when the birds of prey came down on the carcass, Abram drove them away. And as the sun was going down, a deep sleep fell on Abram, and behold, a dreadful and great darkness fell upon him. Then the Lord said to Abram, know for certain that your offspring will be sojourners in the land that is not theirs, and will be servants there, and they will be afflicted for 400 years. But I will bring judgment on the nations that they serve, and afterwards they shall come out with great possessions. As for you, you shall go to your fathers in peace. You shall be buried in a good old age, and they shall come back here in the fourth generation, and for the iniquity of the Amorites is not yet complete. There's some really cool things that we don't have time to talk about with the 400 years and then the sins of the Amorites that are not yet complete. So on your own study, go back and look at those because it's really cool stuff. So then 17, when the sun had gone down, it was dark. Behold, a smoking fire pot and a flaming torch passed between the pieces. This is kind of how God appeared in that smoking pot, flaming torch. And on that day, the Lord made a covenant with Abraham. To your offspring, I give this land from the river of Egypt. So this is kind of giving the borders of the promised land, the Egypt, the great river, the river Euphrates, the land of the Kenites, the Kenizzites, all the ites, and all the ites. Okay. All right. So we have here this scenario where they take, here, you'll be a goat. Come here. So you cut it in half, slice, you fall down, and half of you's over there, half of you's over here. And then, okay, you'll be one half. So sit down over there. Eight, you're the other half of the goat.
All right, by the head of the legs.
You'd be right there. All right, we need two more people.
I want to be a goat.
Okay, no, you're not a goat.
Goat, you're a goat. A goat? You're not the goat.
You're not the goat.
Whatever, you're one of the other dead animals. Okay, so what would happen in normal times was, this was not an unheard of thing. This would have been called a blood covenant, and so they would have cut these animals in half, and normally, Gavin, come here. So let's say Gavin and I are making an agreement together. And so we would cut these animals in half. There would be this reality of, okay, whoever breaks this covenant, may they be like these animals that we just cut in half. Okay, so now, this is going to be the weird part. You got to hold my hand. They would walk through these dead animals as this sign of this covenant. It was kind of like the signing of the dotted line kind of thing. So this would take place. Now, what does God move through this with Abraham? No. He comes down in the form of a fiery pot and goes through himself. So this is big. This is huge. So this is not a conditional covenant. This is God making a promise to you guys. So this is God very clearly making an unconditional covenant. a covenant that is everlasting. So let's jump to chapter 17. For sake of time, I'm not going to read all of this, but chapter 17, he reiterates it, kind of confirms to Abraham again and gives him the sign of circumcision. And so this is a reminder to them of this covenant that God has made. It is unconditional. It is everlasting. So is the Abrahamic covenant still binding today?
It's unending, yes.
Yes, it is. God, the Abrahamic covenant is still true with Israel. Now, this is pretty big. Now,
still true with what?
With Israel. So the land and seed and the blessing is still a promise that will be fulfilled in Israel. Now, we'll see in the new covenant, believers are grafted into some of the blessings and the promise, but the new covenant does not promise us land, seed, and blessing for Gentiles. Does that make sense? Okay, so this is still binding. So I would believe and I would agree with those who bless Israel are blessed and those who curse Israel are cursed even today. Now, understand this. If you talk about this with others that just look at the world and are very anti-Israel right now, it's like the cool thing to be, which has kind of always been that, but to be very anti-Semite is normal right now. And they will say, oh, so if you're pro-Israel, if you're a Zionist, then you agree with everything that Israel is doing. How can you agree with all of Israel's decisions? Well, that's not what this means. This means that we believe that God is not done with Israel. And in that, we will still honor the reality that God has a future for Israel, and we should protect Israel as we can in hopes that they turn to Yahweh, they turn to Jesus and understand that they killed the Messiah, which will happen, and we'll talk about that. But the argument that I'll use too is like, so one of the phrases that we'll say is, man, I gotta keep going. One of the phrases say was like, well, the Israel that is now is not the same Israel as the Old Testament. But say it's just they're a different kind of people group. They're doing atrocities. Therefore, that's not who it really is. So these are the dispensationalists that are trying to justify anti-Semitism right now, essentially. And they'll say, well, there is just this other group that we don't really know that eventually God will bring out. So I say to that, so you're saying the Israelites in the Old Testament were still a part of this covenant. And like, yeah. So Israel in the Old Testament did everything that they were supposed to do, and they didn't do heinous things? No. Israel in the Old Testament has done much worse than current Israel has ever done. So it's not a very good argument. Okay? Does that make sense? Okay. I'll get off my soapbox there.
Move on. Can I have a question?
Yes.
On the notes, the Abrahamic covenant, you have Genesis 12, 1 through 3, 15, 17. That would be chapters, 15 mm-hmm. and chapter 17.
Yes,
not
sorry.
Verses. Okay.
Yeah, entire chapters.
Okay.
We have this little thing with Ishmael, Isaac. There's that, obviously, Abraham tries to take things in his own hands at first. It's not how it's going to be. So then this 17 is kind of a confirmation that you will have your son the right way. Like, you don't go and do this thing to try to usurp my plan. And so then that happens. Isaac comes, and then we see the story of Abraham growing in his faith. And then we have all these things. And then we have birth of Isaac, and then we have sacrifice of Isaac. So my take, this is mine, so this is not. This is my own opinion. So if Tanner might disagree with this, I don't know. I think one of the big points of what God is doing with the concept with Isaac and the sacrifice is, remember when we talked about Molech, child sacrifice was prevalent. That's what it would have been. And that's how they showed their devotion to the God, was to sacrifice their own child. I think what here we see is Yahweh, God, is making the point to Abraham, I want your full devotion. So much so that you're willing to give your son like all the others pagans are. And then when he starts to do that and he says, stop, I'm not that God. Mm. That's kind of my take on it. I don't have black and white scripture on it, but I think that's kind of what's happening. And so we see this reality of kingdom here. We see God saying, I'm different than than these gods. I am not these gods. I am above these gods. These gods do not exist, essentially. So he requires, but he's still showing and requiring full devotion to Yahweh. Okay, so then Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, the covenant is reaffirmed in Isaac. You're going to write these down. We're not going to look at them. And do you have these in your notes? Confirmed in Isaac? I don't know if I could put those in there.
We have no. Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, covenant reaffirmed.
Okay, so you have confirmed in Isaac in Genesis 26, 2 through 5, and then 25. And then you have confirmed in Jacob, Genesis 28, 13 through 15. That's the wrestling with God, if I remember right. And then you have confirmed in the 12 tribes with towards the end with Joseph and his offspring in Genesis 49:10. Okay, so Israel, God uses the time in Egypt to grow them from a nation of 70 to over 2 million men, essentially. So there's huge growth. So God is now fulfilling this seed, starting to fulfill this seed thing. Now they're a great nation. So from Abraham and Isaac and Jacob. And then so Jacob's name is changed to
Israel.
And then he has how many sons? It's more than 12, but
many.
12 that mattered.
12 that mattered. Yeah. Although Dan was one of the tribes early on, and then it's not listed later. Oh, sadly. So then the 12 tribes come from Israel. Jacob, we have them all in the Egypt, and then they become not exiled, what's the word? Captivity. The captivity in Egypt. And then we have Moses comes on the scene. Okay, so this is big. The plagues in, so we're going to be in Exodus. So the plagues are huge for just to do this in half a minute. The plagues, God works through, goes through basically every single realm that the gods of Egypt would have overseen, and Yahweh just establishes the reality that these gods are not real. I am the one true God. And so then you have the Exodus. Exodus is huge. He always points back to it. There's multiple scriptures that talk about don't go back to Egypt. Don't forget what I've done in Egypt. And it was so big that even the cultures around them understood and knew it. Rahab, what she says, we heard what your God did in Egypt. Like, it was a big deal. And we see that, sadly, they do forget it. So we have the Exodus, they come out, and then they end up in Mount Sinai. And so you can imagine, you have these huge people come to the Red Sea, they cross on dry land, they watch the waters pull back, they go through it, and then as they get to the other side, the waters crash in on the Egyptian army. And just a side note, Egypt never recovered from this. They were like huge world power, and then all of a sudden, Egypt's world power status dwindles in history, and it's not really, we don't see him really recover. Egypt is notorious for keeping things out of the records that is a scar on them. So it's kind of actually a pretty good indication that it really happened, because you have Egypt at their heights and all the history, and then all of a sudden, they're no longer the world power. So that's another cool thing. I just remembered, I forgot to mention this, on the back of this, I gave you a timeline. It's kind of a rough, just quick, so you can kind of follow. You can tear it off and look at it next to it just to see the flow of things and when things happen. The Exodus taking place in 1446 BC is really important just for a lot of archaeology things. 1 Kings 6 kind of gives the formula. It says, a certain number of year during this reign of the king after the Exodus. We know the reign of that king. We work that backwards. That gives us 1446. It's actually a really important date in archaeology. A lot of the liberal scholars try to make everything happen later than it really did. And so there's just, it's important to understand that the Exodus happened in 1446 BC. So, we have this covenant with Moses. So just for sake of time, this is a conditional covenant. This is not an unconditional covenant. So there are conditions to this. This is now God really starting to deal with the presence problem. So he has this relationship with him that started through Abraham. It's grown. And now he says, so that I can dwell with my people, you have to be clean. Here's how you are to be clean. And then he gives the tabernacle. They build the tabernacle. We have Bezalel and Oholiab. Those guys get more verses than Elijah and Elisha, believe it or not. And these guys get this incredible ability from the Lord, Holy Spirit given, to be craftsmen and build the tabernacle. The tabernacle is built. The Shekinah glory comes in and dwells in the tabernacle. Okay? I should back up a little bit. So Mount Sinai, Moses goes up the mountain, talks with God. If you notice in Exodus, God actually speaks from the mountain to all the people first before Moses goes up, and all the people are like, I don't want to do that. That's scary. And so then Moses goes up on his own and spends 20 days, gets the tablets, and then what happens during that time? Yeah, they start partying like they're worshiping Egyptian gods. They build this golden calf. So what's going on in their minds is, oh no, Moses has been gone too long. We're seeing all this lightning and smoke up there. Moses is dead. What do we do? And so they're like, I know. We know how to conjure up gods, because when we were in Egypt, let's try to conjure God to tell us what to do. And so that was the golden calf. You see all these different archaeological finds and pictures and sculptures of God's riding on a cow. They're like standing on the back of the calf. And it was this understanding of, this is how we communicate to the gods, is that we have this means of calf riding to get the God to us. So they build this calf. And so it was deviant Yahweh worship. Like, I think in their mind, they're like, okay, we've got to talk to God. And so they do this. But obviously, they were not really understanding how this works, because they slip into all kinds of sexual deviance and all kinds of things. And Moses comes down from the mountain right after this covenant has been made with Moses. This is like fornication on the wedding night. And this is like you get married, and then one spouse goes and cheats on the other spouse on the wedding night. Like, this is a big deal. And Aaron, what does Aaron say? You know, oh, I just threw these things in the fire and out popped the calf. So clearly a big deal. And so this is like the beginning, and God is like, all right, we're starting over. And so then there's this conversation with God and Moses, and then there's this reality that, okay, he punishes those that are that led it. You notice the leaders of Israel are the ones that get punished, and then they move on like I need to do. And so then you have the tabernacle, you have this presence developed. Exodus 6:7, God makes this statement, I will take you to be my people, and I will be your God, and you shall know that I am the Lord your God, who has brought you out of under the burdens of the Egyptians. So I will be your God, you will be my people. This is again kingdom, the beginning of kingdom fixing. It's kind of the beginning of not quite restoration, but it's the beginning of this presence problem being fixed. So now, if you look at the way that the tabernacle is set up, tabernacle's in the middle, everybody's around it, God dwells in the midst of them. If they can deal with their sin problem through sacrifices, the blood of these goats and lambs, it covers sin, it doesn't deal with them all eternally, but it makes it so that they are ceremonially clean, so that now God can dwell with them. Okay. So then we have this time where they are ready to get into the land, and 12 men go into Canaan to spy. And yeah, are you singing the song? 12 men went to spy in Canaan. Yeah, two were good. You know that song? Just don't touch my cereal. Okay. All right. Well, we sang a song. Very good. So who were the two? Caleb and Joshua. Caleb and Joshua said, no, we can do this. The Lord and the other 10 were like, no. All the people follow the 10. They're scared. Oh, no, big giants and all of that. And so God then makes them wander in the wilderness. So now there's this time of like, hey, you guys don't trust me. This is what's going to happen. And so this generation dies off. And then we get to Joshua, the time of Joshua. And they are going to go into the land of Canaan to conquer it. There's a bunch of cool stories there. I wish we could spend more time on, but we can't. And so do they, when they go into the into Canaan, do they do everything that God says? Do they conquer everybody that they were supposed to conquer?
No.
They don't. This becomes a problem later. The point was, and so this is the point of AI, is Achan. He doesn't obey, and it seems really harsh. So Achan's like, well, I'm going to keep some gold for myself, and he puts it in his tent. And then after Jericho, they're supposed to devote to destruction, everything gone, dead, all that stuff. And then Achan steals, and then the Israel's like, whoa, look at us, you know. And which they miss the point of Jericho. Jericho was God saying, I will go before you. Okay, you don't even have to fight. You don't even have to swing your sword. Just do what I say, I will conquer this for you. And they just marched around, you know, for the 7 days, and everything fell, and there's God won a little battle for them. And they get arrogant, they're like, oh, yeah, let's go take on Ai. And Ai is tiny compared to Jericho. Like, and Ai whoops them. And the reason is Achan. And so you have this big, big transition point where God kills Achan and his family because they would have been complicit to it. A lot of times we think, oh, this is terrible because God just killed children. Well, it's really more so it's like the household who would have known, who would have been a part of it. They would have hid it with him. So they're all punished. And it's to say, get the sin out of the camp. This will destroy you. And they don't listen. So we continue to go on in the time of Judges. What's the theme of Judges?
Everyone did.
There was no king, and everyone did what was right in their own eyes. Jump to Deuteronomy 12. Real quick. So remember, Deuteronomy is the second law. Deuteros 2. Deuteronomy, Nomos, law. So second law. So it's given over. The law is given over again. And they're reminded before they go into Canaan how they are supposed to live and act. Deuteronomy 12:8 says, where are you? There you are. You shall not do according to all that we are doing here today, everyone doing whatever is right in their own eyes. For you have not as yet come to the rest and the inheritance that the Lord your God has given you. So, do not do what's right in your own eyes. They forgot that. Because then Judges, there's no king. They didn't honor God as king, and they did right, did what was right in their own eyes. It doesn't work out. So Judges is really cool. The first judge is Othniel, and he doesn't have very much text because he does it right. There was a problem. The judge goes to God. God tells him what to do. He does it. The end. That was the Judges is like this. Almost like the Shakespearean tragedy. Like it spirals out of control. It starts right, how it should be. Othniel, the judge, this is how a judge should be. And it just gets worse and worse. And Gideon is like this turning point where he starts off pretty well. And then he just turns. Like a lot of times we forget the reality of the second half of Gideon. He comes to a village and they won't feed him because they don't have enough to feed all of him and his men. And so they just kill him. There's your judge. And it spirals out of control. Samson's the last one. Samson is the worst judge out of all of them, completely doing everything in his own selfish mindset. So then we have Samuel. Samuel is kind of the end of this. He's the last judge. He is a good judge, but it kind of segues. He's judge prophet. And then from Samuel is where Samuel feels really bad because the people are demanding a king. They're like, we want to be like everyone else. All the other nations have kings. We should have a human king. God is supposed to be their king. And so Samuel is really upset. And God says, no, they have not rejected you. They rejected me. And so let them have their king. And then who's the first king they pick? Saul. So Saul is man's choice. Okay? So Saul is the first king. It's man's choice. You see in your notes, he is no heart. He does not have a heart for God. Okay? And then we have David, who has all heart. Now, who is David known as? The man after? Okay, so I don't know, Tanner, I'm not sure where you fall on this. I don't view that as a statement about David and his devotion. I've kind of understood that more as this is God's choosing. So Saul was man's choosing. David was the man after God's own heart in the sense that God's heart desired David to be the king. And so he was that. I don't know where you're at on that. If you ever thought about it.
First time.
So the phrase that David is a man after God's own heart, I don't think it's a statement on David's heart towards God. I think it's a statement about God's heart towards David, that David was God's choosing. It's like saying, you guys chose Saul as your man, I'm choosing David as my man. And I think the point is to show that even the best guy possible, the best option for man, still cannot be a perfect king. Mm-hmm. That's kind of big to this whole thing. And so David, because he's in military and his war, he wants to build God a temple. And he says, I live in this big house. You still have just this tabernacle. I want to build a temple. So this is, again, following the temple vein through Scripture. So what does God say to him? No, not you. And so jump to 2 Samuel 7. In your notes, you have Genesis 49:10. That's just another nod at from Abraham's line will be kings. So this is kind of there. Genesis 49 is kind of a prophetic nod towards the Davidic covenant. So 2 Samuel 7. I guess I should turn there too. Starting in verse 8. So again, this is this conversation. I want to build you a temple. God says, no, you have blood on your hands. Solomon will later build that temple. Starting in verse 8. Now therefore, thus you shall say to my servant David. So they're talking to the prophet Nathan. Thus says the Lord of hosts, I took you from the pasture, from the following the sheep, that you should be prince over my people Israel, and I have been with you wherever you went, and have cut off all of your enemies from before you, and I will make for you a great name, like the name of the great ones of the earth, and I will appoint a place for my people Israel, and will plant them so that they may dwell in their own place and be disturbed no more. And violent men shall afflict them no more as formerly, from the time that I appointed judges over my people Israel, and I will give you rest from all your enemies. So this is, again, this is like future looking forward to kingdom stuff. This is, you can see how this is building off of the Abrahamic covenant. The Davidic covenant and the Abrahamic covenant are tied together. This is like a building. This is further revelation, progress of revelation. So he's saying, look forward to this king that will come. And then he says, I will give you the rest from your enemies. Moreover, the Lord declares to you that the Lord will make you a house. And when your hands are fulfilled and you lie down with your fathers, I will raise up your offspring after you who shall come from your body and will establish this kingdom. He shall build a house for my name and I will establish the throne of his kingdom forever. Forever. It's an important one there. I will be to him a father and he shall be to me a son. When he commits iniquity, I will discipline him with the rod of men, but the stripes of the son of men. So he's talking about Solomon there. But my steadfast love will not depart from him as I took it from Saul, whom I put away before you. And your house and your kingdom shall be made forever before me. Your throne shall be established forever. In accordance with all these words and in accordance with all this vision, Nathan spoke to David. Okay, so we have this Davidic covenant. We have this covenant with God and David. So I guess we'll do this thing again. So who's it between? God and David. it conditional? No, does any point God say to David, if you do this, then I will do this? No, he doesn't. He just states. So unconditional. Uncondition. And what's that?
Unending.
Everlasting. So this is the Davidic covenant, which is huge, because who's going to eventually come and be the man who's going to sit on the Davidic throne?
Jesus.
Okay, so here's a question. We'll talk about this later, but a little more in depth. Is Jesus currently sitting on the Davidic throne?
Is he what?
Is he currently sitting on the Davidic throne?
No.
No, correct. Because if he was, we would be in the millennial reign. So we're going to talk about this when we get to Jesus. I'm going to wrap kind of this. I'm going to get through in the next 5 minutes. I'll get through to redemption. So we'll blast through this pretty quick. So we have David, this covenant was made with David. There will be a future king that will come from the line of David. He will be the one that brings all of the things. The kingdom restoration will come through this king that will come. Okay? And so we know this as becoming Christ, right? So everlasting, it is forever. It is not something that is conditional, that Israel can do bad, and then God will remove this from them. This is everlasting. This is huge. So Abrahamic covenant, everlasting. Davidic covenant, everlasting. A lot of the other theologies out there, like covenant theology, those that believe in amillennialism will say these were conditional and that they no longer are binding, or they will change it a little bit to say, well, they're just allegorically described to fit what the church will be now. And so they just kind of twist it, and they don't make a distinction between Israel and the church. They'll just say the church is the new Israel. So all of these covenantal promises that were made to Israel were actually intended to be made to the church. Now, I don't know about you, but to me that says God is being a liar. Saying that when he's making these, he's deceiving Abraham, he's deceiving David, and the prophets. Because, so again, go back to literal reading, the authorial intent, simply meaning, the meaning of the truth is found within that text. Yes, other texts help us illuminate deeper what that is, but this isn't something that's just God's going, okay, I'm going to make this covenant, and in the back of God's mind going, but it's not really going to fulfill the way you think and you understand, because this isn't really actually for you, because you're going to fail on it, and then I'm going to bring in the church later. It's kind of deceptive if you think about it that way. So then Solomon comes in. He has a heart divided. He starts off, he builds the temple, 2 Chronicles 7, 1 through 3, 12 through 22. We see the temple concluded, and then all of the glory of God fills the temple. This is like the prime moment in Old Testament temple storyline. God comes and dwells in the temple with his people. It's a big deal. They have a huge dedication ceremony. They sacrifice. You look that passage up, it's thousands and thousands of animals. But Solomon, does he keep true to his devotion to the Lord? No, he likes foreign women and ends up, he even builds a temple to essentially what would have been Molech, the same god that's sacrificing babies, because he had a wife that wanted to honor her god, so they built that. So like Solomon has this major faux pas in his life. And so the kingdom is split, it's divided, it goes to Rehoboam, Jeroboam, the kingdom splits. One of the first things that Rehoboam does is he puts up, you guys remember? Yeah, Asher, high places. So in Bethel, which is Bethel north or south? Like Bethel south. So Bethel and Dan, it's on the two ends. And so because that's the northern kingdom, Israel, and then the southern kingdom is Judah, the southern kingdom has the temple. And he's like, well, they can't go into enemy territory to worship. We've got to build these high places. High places were like little, basically little temples. So it's very God is very clear that you will not have other high places. You will have just this one. 2 Kings 17 really talks about that. When we were in, no, you didn't go there, because that was the, were you in Arad? Did you go on the Jordan side? So in Arad, it's very south, very far south, south of the Dead Sea. There is this fortified city called Arad, and they have, it's a high place that the markings on it, engravings on it, it is both to Yahweh and all these other foreign gods. And it would have dated around the same time as Solomon, Rehoboam time period. Like, this is major, major problems. Okay, so you see where Israel is not honoring their covenant. The kingdom splits. And so now you have this time of prophets and kings. So remember, Samuel is kind of the half judge prophet. More prophets come. And so we have this period of time where there is the prophets and kings. It's just a process of bad decision after bad decision. And prophets keep trying to remind the kings. And occasionally there's a few good kings that do some good. And as soon as they're gone, the next generation falls back away. They continue to serve other gods, which is the problem that 2 Kings passage explains, why the Assyrians come in and they go into Assyrian captivity. And then later they fall to Babylon and they go into Babylonian captivity. Right after that, the glory of the Lord leaves the temple, Ezekiel 10. That is a very low point in temple history. So you have these, and then shortly after God leaves, the temple is destroyed by King Nebuchadnezzar, and then they're in exile for 70 years, and then through the process of their returning under King Cyrus, they return from Israel, and then Zerubbabel and Nehemiah, through that whole process, the second temple is built, and this is what we would call second temple period. So Jesus is functioning under what would be considered the second temple period, and Herod makes an upgrade remodel to it later, but that's still considered a second temple. And so you have all the prophets, they're looking forward to the Messiah, the king will come, they're excited. Exile fixes the polytheism that they keep tying to. So that's a good thing to know. After the exile, Israel doesn't really deal with this idea of polytheism, of worshiping other gods. They stay really pretty committed to Yahweh. So much so that Jesus can't be God. Mm-hmm. Make sense? Okay. So then we have the silent period. So for about 400 years, the end of Malachi till Matthew 1, we have a period where God does not directly give any revelation. There's no prophets that record anything. There's a lot of really cool history in this silent period, things that really set the stage for Jesus. I encourage you to study that because it's really cool, helpful stuff. It is one of the benefits of the additions to the Catholic Bible. It's not inspired. It's not text, but it gives us some helpful history of the Maccabeans. There's the Essenes that happened during this time, which are kind of really cool people group. So anyways, all of that stuff, really good. The Hellenization of everything through Herod the Great sets the stage. Rome comes in and has their authority. And so before we get into the next stage, Israel is under occupation of the Roman government. They all speak Greek for the most part. Hebrew is, by this time, kind of, it's not completely forgotten, but only the real religious Jews know Hebrew. So that's kind of the context of where we're at when we come back. So